The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud, where each week three of our writers read out their pieces in the magazine. This week we're joined by Kevin Hurley, who is the former Police and Crime Commissioner for Surrey, and he gives his opinion on why relations between some black youths and the police is just so bad. We're also going to be joined by Alicia Monckton, who writes about the private state gap between students during this lockdown. And last, James Dillingpole reviews Alan Bennett's new Talking Heads and writes about why he's not such a fan. First up, Kevin Hurley.
I was a borough commander in West London and come from a long line of officers. And I can tell you that it's fast becoming impossible to police the streets. The police are attacked on all sides. They're both told that they're too aggressive and too politically correct, too understanding and too intolerant. They're required to reduce the level of violent crime on the street, and yet told they're racist if they stop and search young black men and put hands in pockets to check for knives. As a society, we can shout and scream at the police, regulate them, scrutinise them, sack a few, bring in external bosses from industry. We can try to re-educate them and have an independent complaint system. But unless we look clearly at the real problems street constables and junior detectives face every day, our cities will soon be lawless. The first thing to understand is that the police are not a homogeneous group. A response police officer in Inner London has little in common with a commissioner or senior officers, save they wear a similar uniform. While both groups want to think they make a difference, the chiefs will be thinking of long-term strategies, managing budgets, building relationships with other government officers. Occasionally, they'll be diverted into thinking about some fast-moving issue, such as a terrorist event or newspaper criticism of the handling of a major inquiry. Once dealing with dynamic events is no longer their daily business, police chiefs can forget what it's like to be a superintendent or inspector. They want good press, and they become calculating and political in the pursuit of the top job. The street cops generally come from fairly good homes. Most have decent educations. A lot of them nowadays have been to university or have done a variety of jobs before they joined, from infantrymen in Afghanistan to nurses or restaurant managers. The majority are still white, but that's no surprise really. Most have joined due to having had positive exposure to police officers in the past. A surprising number of police officers are, like me, related to other police officers or to service personnel. No one who joins the police would express a racist view when being selected or during training. To express such a view in the workplace would be suicidal to their careers and would, at the very least, result in several of their colleagues turning on them. So, why do so many young black people loathe the police? Why is there so much violence? It comes down to what in police circles is known as the Batari box of human behaviour. This describes a vicious circle. Your behaviour influences my behaviour. My behaviour influences your behaviour. This is how it works. Imagine a newly minted PC arriving on an inner London borough where black-on-black stabbings and murders are a priority. Together with an experienced colleague, she will approach a pair of known street criminals to ask them what they're doing in a particular location. But as the officers approach, the young men will often start to be abusive, saying, "You're only picking on me because I'm black." A big crowd of people will then surround the officers and start to shout, even obstruct them. The police will call for help, and help will arrive with sirens blaring. The police will either dominate or they'll run away, withdraw. After such an encounter, inevitably complaints will be made against the police officers. And after a few more episodes like this, our young officer's Batari box has become fixed. She thinks, if I try to solve problems and keep the black community safe, I'm accused of bigotry. Meanwhile, the myth of police racism continues, and the black youths at that incident convince themselves that they were picked on in an unjustified search. It's often the best young officers who become most disillusioned. I remember one young street crime officer in central London who had a prolific arrest rate of criminals. The secret of his success was loitering around Victoria Railway Station, learning the known suspects' faces and observing carefully. It was difficult, dangerous and violent work. Making arrests in plain clothes next to the live rail. But it was rewarding. Because his 25 most recent arrests were all black youths, this officer was called in by his superintendent and told he was racially biased. The officer replied, but most of the muggings and snatches in this area are being done by black youths. The senior officer said, that's not the point. I think you need to go on a racial awareness course. The superintendent put an adverse comment on the officer's file and blocked his application for promotion. The officer gave up arresting robbers and became an errand boy for the CID, going out and arresting their burglary suspects identified by fingerprints. Most burglars are white. It was safe work. When I was a borough commander in West London, I asked the crime analyst to identify the 10 most prolific robbers in the area and the 10 most violent gang members. When they'd been identified, I stuck their photographs up on the exit door from the station into the police vehicle car park. This is where the PCs drank their tea before going on patrol. So my idea was that this way, even the most idle officers would have to look at and learn the criminals' faces before they went out on patrol. Then my senior officer came on what we'd call a royal visit. He wanted to know how we did so well at reducing robbery and why we had no youth murders. As I explained our various tactics and we went out to the car park door, he noticed the 20 photos and said, why have you got all these black youth pictures stuck up here? You can't do that. It sends the wrong message to any visitors. When I explained my rationale, my boss replied, well, take them down and put some white ones up as well. But these are the men identified as the most high risk to the public by our civilian analysts, I answered. I was told, I don't care. We can't have this. Take them down. When my boss left, I ignored his instructions. The safety of the public was more important to me. Though my boss made sure I wasn't promoted again, we remained a top-performing borough. We had no youth murders, and my successor soon inherited the only inner-city borough not to face rioting or looting in 2011. For many people, the idea that the police are racist fits with their view of history. It's not all unfounded. They think of the abominations suffered at colonial hands, the terrible experiences of the Windrush generation, and the racism of the 1950s and 1960s. It's a toxic mix. It is also too often the case now that black fathers are absent, leaving mothers and grandmothers to bring up the kids. Often these women are forced to be away from the children, working all hours in hard, low-paid jobs, such as carers or cleaners. Sometimes doing two jobs or struggling on benefits. Is it any wonder that so many young black boys end up in trouble? So there is no doubt that they suffer social disadvantages. But then so do many poor white children. The result of all of this is that the police have given up being inquisitive. Most people don't realise the most important quality in a copper is to be nosy. You've got to want to investigate and get to the bottom of a problem. If police lose their appetite to investigate, this would be a disaster for black families. It would mean many more mothers would lose their sons to the knife, gun, or a lifetime in prison. It would mean that our streets would become scarier and that county lines would flourish, bringing drugs into our leafy shires and blighting the lives of more black children. If black lives really mattered, we would change the conditions that result in this carnage. But we don't. That is real institutional, systemic racism.
That was Kevin Hurley. Now, Alicia Monckton.
When Boris Johnson announced the easing of lockdown this week, there was nothing for schools. Pubs, yes. Theme parks, even. But the education of children? There is no great rush for that, it seems. First things first, I have a 14-year-old daughter, at a state grammar, and like so many parents, I am in despair. The 2-metre rule, which had presented such problems for schools, is finally being relaxed. But far from cheering the move as a crucial step towards getting children into the classroom, the teaching unions are still cavilling, advising head teachers to ensure they have contingency plans for bringing only half of pupils back on a rotating basis. The Prime Minister has said all pupils should return in September, but he's not making it compulsory, so parents are still at the mercy of the unions. Indeed, following Tuesday's announcement, Jeff Barton of the Association of School and College Leaders maintained the ambition was pure fantasy. Our daughter's school has merely said it is working on the notion of a September return, albeit with an adapted timetable. Private schools, meanwhile, have promised a full resumption. Some have hired marquees. 4 in 5 prep school pupils are back in class already. During lockdown, they remained pretty well taught. Researchers at the Institute of Education at University College London recently found that 31% of private schools are providing 4 or more online lessons a day. Just 6% of state schools do the same. 71% of state school pupils are receiving less than an hour's teaching a day. When I learned of these figures, I moved beyond frustration to fury, and I am far from alone. You might think a grammar school would be keen to maintain a reputation for academic excellence. Not a bit of it. At our daughter's school, parents have been told the girls should not be overburdened and that their well-being must come first. I would suggest that the mental health of pupils would be far better served by being fully occupied. My daughter has classmates who claim not to have completed a single piece of work since lockdown began on the 23rd of March. Meanwhile, a friend in the same year group, who attends a private school, has had a full timetable online from day one. She is at the computer in uniform every day from 8:30 a.m. Every lesson in the curriculum is delivered online with interactive feedback. Then comes a full programme of extracurricular activities, including music masterclasses, arts and crafts, and debating. Until recently, pupils at Britain's best state schools had been getting better results than those at the best private schools. Lockdown will have brought an end to this. Even if Gavin Williamson, or his replacement, gets a grip and all children are able to return, full-time, in September, the focus will be on the worst hit. The government's trumpeted £1 billion package is unlikely to benefit the kids who have been bumping along. The richest have had private schools, the poorest will get extra help, but the children of the squeezed middle will just have to get on with it. Those who had expected to be in direct competition with their privately educated peers for places at top universities do not figure in the discussion. Neil Roskilly of the Independent Schools Association tells me they're getting more and more demands from parents, particularly for places at primaries. And why? Because no one is in any doubt that the attainment gap, the source of so much belated hand-wringing in Whitehall, has widened by the week. As Professor Francis Green, who led that UCL study, concluded, everyone is losing out in this generation, but some much more than others. Those with the means are getting the hell out of the state sector. I'm tempted too. I have watched our daughter, an only child, happier with her own company than most, steadily wither over these past 3 months. She needs peer stimulation and the encouragement and the admonishments of her teachers, the interactions that make school a school. The initial motivation is long gone. She is alternately sad and frustrated, though coping better than many, if my conversations with other parents are anything to go by. Unlike our friends' children, who have reportedly been horrified and wholly resistant to the idea of moving school at this late stage, she is begging us to explore alternatives. It's a momentous decision to make under pressure, and at such a crucial juncture in her education, not to mention her social development. In a time of instability, is it wise to remove a constant? What if she is unhappy? Can we afford it? But then, with another lockdown being discussed, can we afford not to?
That was Alicia Monkton. And finally, James Dillingpole.
The big mistake people make with Alan Bennett is to conflate him with his fellow Yorkshireman, David Hockney. But whereas Hockney's art is generous, warm, bright, life-affirming, Bennett's is crabbed, catty, dingy, insinuating. The fact that the BBC-led establishment keeps telling us he's a national treasure tells us more about the BBC-led establishment than it does about Bennett. Bennett is typical of the English intelligentsia, Orwell anatomised in his The Lion and the Unicorn essay. Open quote. It is always felt that there is something slightly disgraceful in being an Englishman, and that it is a duty to snigger at every English institution, from horse racing to suet puddings. End quote. I'd forgotten quite how much I disliked Bennett, till I was reminded by the BBC's revival this week of his universally acclaimed 1980s monologues, Talking Heads. No Thora Heard this time, obviously, but lots of really top-notch thespian talent, Harriet Walter, Sarah Lancashire, Martin Freeman, etc., going through their paces, dusting down their special accents, meaningful expressions and pregnant pauses, paying homage to the master, who is now 86. The one I particularly hated was one of the two new ones he's written, An Ordinary Woman. This begins with Lancashire, as an apparently amiable, down-to-earth Yorkshire mum, describing the moment when her 15-year-old son asks her to inspect a worrying spot on his penis, and she realises that she actually finds him sexually attractive. Is this a common phenomenon? Personally, I found it creepy and weird, and rather resented having to spend half an hour of life listening as, on Bennett's behalf, Lancashire riffed on this bizarro theme. It's a notion that Kate Bush sort of touched on in her song Infant Kiss, but at least Bush has the excuse of being away with the fairies, poetically oblique and oddly innocent. With Bennett, on the other hand, you get far too much prurient detail. Mum wondering whether on the other side of the partition wall dividing their bedrooms, her 15-year-old son is masturbating and getting aroused by the idea of it. They say that as civilizations collapse, as ours is now, the intellectual elite become morbidly obsessed with the decadent and perverse. You'd really need to be a BBC commissioning editor, I think, or a theatrical lovey like the director who oversaw this project, Nicholas Heitner, to greet a TV monologue half-celebrating, or at least not wholly condemning, maternal incest with anything other than a 10-foot barge pole. And I'm not buying the defence that Bennett is merely inhabiting the minds of the marginalised and the downtrodden. There's one of his throwaway lines at the end, except of course with Bennett nothing is throwaway, where the mother takes a pill to cure her condition because it, open quotes, makes you indifferent to one another like families normally are, end quote. But are families normally indifferent to one another? Only in the imaginations of the jaded, the sick and the Marxist, I'd say. Perhaps Bennett himself had a disappointing upbringing which he never got over, I don't know. But if I were his psychiatrist, I'd find reams of material. The querulous, gay, mentally ill character in A Chip in the Sugar, played by Bennett himself in the original version and in this one by Martin Freeman, all but imprisoned with his mother, like Tony Last, forced to read Dickens to Mr. Todd for all eternity. And in Soldiering On, the widow and doting mother played by Harriet Walter, still utterly besotted with the vile son who won't visit her and who has reduced her to a joyless, penurious existence, gorging on daytime TV. Open quote, I wouldn't want you to think this was a tragic story. I'm not a tragic woman, not that type, Walters's indomitable, stiff-upper-lipped English woman tells us at the end of that particular monologue. But the irony is bitter and unconsoling, and my feeling is that Bennett despises his characters and the Englishness they embody more than he loves them. Take the relish with which he sets up the character of the antique dealer, played by Kristin Scott Thomas, who spends the first half telling us what a good eye she has and how wise she is to all the tricks of the trade, and the second ruining the potential millions she has lost, giving away for a song a Raphael drawing her expert eye failed to identify. Her mistake, of course, was to have been a hard-working, decent member of the English bourgeoisie. Had she been a smelly old tramp lady in a van, Bennett would have treated her to a hagiography. Don't get me wrong, I'm fully alive to the charm and wit and fluency of Bennett's writing, the way he captures so perfectly the ticks and cadences of spoken English, though he's better at doing Yorkshire folk than he is his somewhat caricatured upper middle classes. And I do think The History Boys, The Madness of George III and Wind in the Willows make great nights out, but the politics, the bitchiness and the misanthropy underneath are pure poison.
That was James Dillingpool. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week. And remember, if you don't subscribe to the magazine already, you can do so by going to spectator.co.uk/voucher in order to get a £20 Amazon voucher as well as a subscription.
The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.